Good day, and welcome to the Roth Capital 2Q20 call series. Today's conference is being recorded, and at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Dr. Yasmeen Rahimi. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you, everyone, for joining part two of our call series with Immunic Therapeutics. For some of you who may have missed part one, we featured a call with Dr. Michael Mills from the University of Chicago to talk about AMU-838 for COVID-19. If you missed it, please reach out to me or our sales team. We'll make sure that you get the replay. It's really a pleasure to have you on the call with us, the team of Immunic Therapeutics. On the call with us is Dr. Daniel Vett, President and Director of Immunic Therapeutics, as well as Dr. Andreas Mueller, Chief Medical Officer. Before we get started and we plug away on numerous questions we have for the team, I want to remind everyone that if you have questions on the call, please email me directly at yrahimi@roth.com or your salesperson, and I will make sure to ask them of the team. So with housekeeping items behind us, we have lots to cover over the next hour. Daniel and Andreas, can you share your conflicts of interest with us besides Immunic Therapeutics? And then we'll jump right with our first question.
Yeah, I have no conflict of interest as Daniel, other than being employee of Immunic.
Yes, it's the same for me. I have no conflict of interest other than for Immunic.
Thank you. Thanks, team. Daniel, can you, for investors who are new to Immunic, can you briefly walk me through the history of the company? When and then from whom did you acquire your lead assets, AMU-838, from? And also, if there are any royalty obligations, if any of you could share that with us.
Yeah, thank you, Yas. Sure, happy to do that. So I think we started Immunic not too long ago in 2016, and that was all based on the idea to have safe and well-tolerated treatment options, oral treatment options for chronic inflammation and autoimmune diseases, where we have seen a medical need for a couple of different indications. And so the founder team, the four of us, we had a lot of discussions around that, and we were in the lucky situation that we were able to buy or acquire in an asset deal two programs from a German biotech company, 4SC, which I co-founded in 1997. Since 4SC was focusing on oncology at that time, it was a good time to really focus here on something different and to really look to dedicate resources to that. I think it was a good deal for everybody involved at that time. And so we were in the lucky situation that we convinced some leading European VCs to help us in starting that with a solid Series A financing of $32 million. Since it was an asset deal, there are no major obligations associated to A38 so far. We still owe 4SC 4.4% royalty. I think that's basically it.
Thank you for the color. And then, Daniel, what is the patent protection for the lead asset, AMU-838?
Yeah, so as typical for molecules like this, so AMU-838, maybe as a background, this is a calcium salt of a small molecule, vidofludimus, very small 355 molecular weight molecule. And therefore, there are several layers of patents on that. So starting from the active moiety through composition of matter of what we use right now, which is the calcium salt, that patent goes until 31. On top of that, we were able and guided by development, we were able to file some more patents. So there are several layers on top of that. I want to mention a patent which is, I think, very important for the long-term protection and may really offer really extended patent runtime. That's linked to the dosing regimen we are using. And this patent was filed in 17. So if that is granted, that may protect us even until 2037.
Thank you, Daniel. We're going to work through systematically from program to program. So given that AMU-838 is furthest along in development in a phase 2B in RRMS, maybe can you share with us what is the market opportunity in RRMS? And then, Andrea, if you could share with us and educate our investors who are new to the MS field, what are the available treatment options and where would AMU-838 fit?
Yeah, thank you, Yas. I think that's the key question, I think. What is the market? I think let's have a different look. What is the patient need? I think that's the driver we are talking about here. So the patient need we see clearly in something which is safe, well-tolerated, and efficacious. And if you look on the plenty of molecules which are currently used for treating this difficult and challenging disease, there's not a single molecule which can solve the problem. So there's still, even if you treat patients with highly active integrin inhibitors like Tysabri, there's still a progress of the underlying disease, specifically progressing of disability of the patients. And we identified two needs, and we are trying to address here. One need is really the early treatment. So something which is easy to use and so safe and tolerable, and also does not require a lot of screening, for example, or preparation of work, and safe and efficacious. So and in that space, we position A38 as a drug. And the second is more on the back end of the therapies, where the current treatments may have some disadvantages. For example, B-cell antibodies, which do a very good job on preventing relapses, on the downside, they are depleting B-cells. So is there a way to maybe think of a further treatment down the road to get a better safety or long-term maintenance therapy? That's more in the concept phase. I think we are focusing more on the early treatment right now. And Andreas, I think you can follow up here.
Yes, so I would like to address maybe your question, Yas, in terms of what is the treatment options that you have in general. I think in general you have three types of treatment options, groups of treatment options that are available for MS. MS started to have really good treatment options available since probably like a little bit more than 20 years ago now. And the first treatment options that you had were these injectables that you inject subcutaneously, intramuscularly, they are still available, but I think they have been overtaken by basically the other two treatment options. One is the biologics, so monoclonal antibody that either address, for example, CD19, CD20 antibodies, or that are anti-integrin antibodies. And those have been shown to have a very good efficacy rate in MS as well. So these are mainly IV treatment options or subcutaneous treatment options. The last group that really becomes more and more important are oral treatment options, because they interfere less with the social life. These are MS patients are usually young. They're usually in their 20s and 30s when they are diagnosed. They're predominantly female, and they're still active in their social life. And oral treatment options have become more and more important to MS patients, because they don't interfere with their social life. They allow you to basically participate and work, and that's very important to patients. So I think here's also where Aubagio, and I think Aubagio was mentioned here because teriflunomide, which is the drug in Aubagio, is another DHODH inhibitor with the same mechanism of action like IMU-838 that we're developing, and that's already on the market and have been quite successful in the market with about $2 billion in sales now on an annual basis. And I think where Aubagio really fit in and really was becoming successful in MS patients was that they offer this more convenient treatment option that is an oral treatment option, allows you to continue with your life, and also on top of it have that mechanism of action, DHODH inhibition, that provides a safety net against PML, which is kind of the major side effects of other treatment, of many other treatment options in MS. It's a rare, adverse event of these treatments. So they really don't happen that often, but they have a lethality of about 80%. So many patients die who develop this kind of virus reactivation. And Obagi was known that it doesn't carry that risk, that really made it very easy for patients to basically choose that treatment option, that oral treatment option.
Thank you, Daniel Andres. You know, you spoke of AMU-838, similar to Obagi being a DHODH inhibitor. So for our audience who's listening and new to Munich, can you maybe first tell us what is the difference in chemistry between AMU-838 and Obagi? And then maybe educate us, what is the PK/PD difference between your acid and Obagi? And what is the safety differences between these two drugs?
Yeah, so maybe I start, being a chemist by training, I start with that. I think it's important to make clear that it's a different chemical class. So IMU-838 is a selective DHODH inhibitor. And maybe worth to mention here, it is based on its chemistry, it's not fitting into binding pockets of kinases, and therefore we don't see any off-target toxicities or side effects driven by binding to kinases, which is known for and published for Obagio as a treatment. And the chemistry is quite different from Obagio, to be honest.
So maybe I can continue here, basically elaborating a little bit more on the safety part, which really I think is the differentiation between IMU-838 with a very clean safety profile because we're a selective immunomodulator does not inhibit any kinases at the concentration that we have in the body, very different from Obagio, and that's why we see this very clean safety profile here. And of course, safety in itself is only important because it reflects on other things for the patient. For example, when it comes to treatment discontinuation, if it comes to basically how much you're able to continue your daily activities without being interfered with, I think that's very important. And I think here the safety difference that we have seen for IMU-838 versus Obagio in the safety profile, the absence, for example, of hair loss, of diarrhea, very important to MS patients and young MS patients and female MS patients. They may not sound like a big deal, but I think if you're an MS patient, they really interfere with your ability to live your life and not think about your treatment all the time. And when you look at the rate of treatment discontinuations that are caused by adverse events, both in real life studies but also in the clinical trials, we see that especially these two, diarrhea and alopecia, hair loss, basically contribute a lot to the discontinuation and to the dissatisfaction of patients. The other difference is the PK profile, and I think, yes, you mentioned already that we should address the PK profile. Teriflunomide Obagio has a blood half-life of about 19 days, so 1.8 or 1.9 days, which makes it very difficult sometimes to discontinue treatments. And discontinuation can be important for these patients, not only because you want to change treatment, that's also sometimes the fact, but these young patients, they either become pregnant or they want to become pregnant. And Obagio, with its PK profile, it will take several months, up to 2 years, to get basically teriflunomide out of your body, out of your bloodstream, and be able to safely get pregnant, if you plan to get pregnant. So here, IMU-838 with a blood half-life of 30 hours, I think is also very important because you can just discontinue your treatment, and that will ensure that the drug leaves the body and you have the ability to discontinue treatment. Whereas with Aubagio, there is a accelerated elimination procedure for about 11 days. You have to swallow some resin. That's a very unpleasant procedure that ensures that the drug leaves the body within 14 days. And this is something that is very unpleasant for patients, and it's a consideration also for patients when they go into treatment. So I think here we see, in a lot of ways, we see many differences in IMU-838 and Aubagio that really address what we think is the main advantage of IMU-838 being a safer, more convenient, more tolerable drug that has a longer durability of treatment and less discontinuation for the patient.
Thank you, Andreas and Daniel, for the color. Andreas, you pointed out that it's very difficult to, wash these patients off of teriflunomide, and, they have to take this resin to really excrete it out. So what percentage of patients go through that? Where do we have an estimate in that regard? And then the second thing is, what is the safety, the compliance to Aubagio in terms of long-term?
Yes, so I don't have exact numbers from real life and how many patients go through, but if you talk to a neurologist, in principle, every patient who discontinues goes through that accelerated elimination procedure, more or less, because I think for most patients, whatever they do, whatever the reason is for the discontinuation, I think a 3 months to 2 year time frame for discontinuation is not an option for these patients, because they need to go on another treatment, or they have some other plans. So I think almost all patients do this. The second question was, sorry, I hung up.
Yeah,
the first
second question. The second question was, what is the compliance rate to Aubagio long term?
Yeah.
How does the safety?
Yes.
Impact the compliance.
Yeah, so there are several data points that we have. And I think clinical trials are often, patients are more compliant there because they have an incentive to go into the clinical trial and to stay in the clinical trial. So what we have seen in the phase 3 trial, for example, for teriflunomide, and it's relatively similar to other oral drugs that have a similar discontinuation rate. You are in the range of maybe 15 to 20% of patients that discontinue treatment within the first 12 to 18 months in these treatments. When you look at real life situations, because they're often patients don't have the same patients with the treatment, they have an easier way of discontinue or switching treatments. And they're also, I think the culture of medical use and patients are also plays a role. So you have seen different results, but I've seen somewhere from basically 30 or 25 to 50% discontinuation rates for some of the drugs within the first 2 years of treatment. So many patients discontinue treatment for many reasons. Of course, safety is just one problem, but I think it's one of the major problems that you run into safety problems that really interfere with your life in these young patients.
Thank you. And do we know what percentage of these patients exhibit these side effects? Is this seen across all patients who are compliant to it?
So we know from teriflunomide, from Aubagio, we know the rates that they have certain side effects. For example, if you look at diarrhea, which I said is very important to these patients because it really interferes with their daily life. It's about 13 to 14% of the patients. Alopecia, it's about 10 to 13% of the patients. And you have liver enzyme elevations also seen in 13 to 15% of patients. And of course, these happen in placebo patients if you compare it as well. But I think you see a highly increased rate of these side effects in patients that get treated with Aubagio. And I think these rates necessarily, not all of these patients discontinue drug, for example. But if you talk to neurologists that treat MS patients, especially the diarrhea and hair loss, alopecia patient side effect is really cumbersome for patients because you have alternatives there for other drug that you would like to try. So it's not happening in a lot of patients, but it interferes with the daily life for these patients.
Thank you. So majority of the dropout rates is attributed to side effect profile, not necessary due to efficacy.
So I wouldn't say that, because I think with every treatment and in the natural course of the disease, you will still have some sort of problems in terms of either relapse, which is, I think, a more acute event where the patient suddenly has new neurological symptoms, suddenly, you know, can't walk, can't see or double vision, or has some other problems with feeling certain areas of the skin or some other areas. So it's a broad spectrum of, but this is a very acute event. But also, I think sometimes you have this slow progression of the disease, yes, that doesn't have an acute event, that's called disability progression. So that slowly but surely in this disease, you accumulate more disability. And sometimes that's also a concern for patients that they would like to get escalated. So often these therapies in MS, they work on an escalation basis. So you start with therapies that are considered relatively safe and that have a good protective effect for you, but if you have ongoing neurological symptoms or relapses, the physician will think about basically escalating you to a different therapy that maybe is less safe or less convenient, but it offers a higher degree of protection. And that's what's usually happening. So some of these discontinuation also have to do with treatment escalations that are due to ongoing disability progression or to relapse events.
Thank you, Andreas. Your emphasis faced to be studies fully enrolled, and we expect 24-week top-line data in the third quarter. Have you given further guidance if we should see the data in early or late 3Q20? And then can you share with us which endpoints we will be seeing at the final analysis of the main treatment period, and how will the study continue?
Yes, so we have given the guidance that we will have the top line data, unblinded top line data from our phase 2B trial, emphasis trial in relapsing remitting MS, available in third quarter 2020. And we are on track for that. And it will be almost exactly in the middle of the third quarter. So if that's of interest. and the endpoints that you see, I think, you can see this from our public entries into, for example, clinicaltrials.gov, that our primary endpoint, very similar to other phase 2 trials, traditional phase 2 trials for almost all of the MS treatment regimens that are available, will be a MRI endpoint. And especially the endpoint that we're looking at, the primary endpoint, is basically a cumulative new active lesions. And what it does is, basically, you put a patient on treatment, either placebo or your treatment, IMU-838 here in this trial, with 30 or 45 milligrams, and you look how many new lesions in the MRI you develop in the patient's brain over 24 weeks. And the readout that you will get is basically how much suppression of the MRI activity you get under treatment as compared to a placebo patient. So this is roughly our estimate for the sample size that we have done, that basically you expect a certain number of lesions in to develop over 24 weeks in a placebo patient. And what you look for in this trial is to how many less percentage lesions the relative decrease of lesion counts you have when you treat this patient. And this is, I think, what you have to look for, and what we are looking for as a readout of this trial. And then, of course, you can break out these lesions into different types, MS experts, they know that, for example, you have gadolinium enhancing lesion. This is a contrast media that you give into the bloodstream of the patient, and it basically highlights some of the most active lesions. They're called gadolinium lesions, but you also have what's called T1 and T2 lesions. These are basically MRI sequences that you use to image the brain of a patient, and you count lesions there. So basically what we're using as a primary endpoint is any new lesion that develop either as gadolinium lesion, T1 or T2 lesion, they're summarized as new active lesions, and that's what we will result as the main outcome. But we also have a lot of other outcomes, other MRI measures. We also basically have outcomes on the safety, which is very important. We also have outcomes that are more clinically related, although probably the sample size in this phase two trial is not yet sufficient to have a statistical effect, but we want to see trends in clinical outcome measures variables as well.
Thank you, Andreas. Obviously, as we're really excited to and look forward to the data, a big question for investors will come in: what has Obagi shown in new lesions at week 24? So is there a data
yes.
set that could show that, and so that investors can benchmark the results we get from 383? And then maybe help us also understand what rate reduction in MRI lesions do you consider a home run out of the study?
Yes. So I think the good news is with the design that we had chosen for the phase two, very different to some recent phase two readouts that were done with a different methodology, that we really wanted to have a phase two trial and a design that makes it easier for us and also for observers or investors to get a good comparative assessment versus other drugs, and especially versus teriflunomide. So teriflunomide had done a phase two trial that's also published a few years ago, about 6, 7, 8 years ago, that did a very similar, if not identical, methodology in terms of basically doing MRIs every 6 weeks. Going up to week 24, they actually continue to week 36, but this, you also have the basically 24-week data available from Obagio. And what they had shown is, and what I explained basically, that placebo has a certain number of MRI lesions, of new MRI lesions that develop over 24 weeks, and then Obagio, depending on the dose, that also tested two doses in the phase two trial, had suppressed about 55 to 60% of the lesion. So that's, I think, the benchmark for us, and it needs to be the benchmark for us as well. Meaning that, for example, if a placebo patient had 10 lesions, new lesions, as an example, an Obagio patient would have maybe only 5 lesions developed during their 24-hour time frame. And that's also, I think, what you can expect from IMU-838 as a readout, that we will basically present to you the reduction of lesions in the treated patients for the 30 and the 45 milligram dose. And as a base case, I think we would assume that we reach the same level of MRI lesion suppression, and because I think basically because we have the same mechanism of action, and really the advantage of this drug is on the safety tolerability profile. There are some reasons why we could have a better efficacy, but I think in general, I think the base case that where we are planning for example, for phase three or continuing studies will be that we have the same efficacy as Obagio.
Thank you, Andreas. But expectation, base case, and there's also, given the safety profile, that one could push also the efficacy higher. That's helpful. And then can you help us with how the number of MRI lesions, how they're correlated with the annualized relapse rate, which is a regulatory endpoint? So what is the correlation?
Yeah.
If you could maybe give us tidbits of where we can find the
yes.
reference to that and the
yep.
strength of the correlation
yep.
between these two important markers.
Yes. So, yes, this has been an ongoing discussion in the MS community and with companies developing new drugs in the MS field for quite a while, since the mid-90s, what endpoints to use and how MRI, which is more or less I would consider like a surrogate endpoint, MRI lesions, how this relates to clinical endpoints, because a lot of companies wanted to basically use also MRI for phase 3 studies, and regulatory agencies have resisted this and basically said that you need to have a more clinically relevant endpoint for the phase 3 studies. However, because so many studies have been done in MS in using MRI endpoints, the surrogate endpoint, that we understand very well the relationship between MRI endpoints and clinical endpoints. For example, how the reduction of MRI lesions that I just described, for example, for this phase 2 trial, how does translate into reduction of relapse activity, which is often what is measured in the phase 3 programs. And there's a very good meta-analysis that was done by a statistician in Italy, very well known in the MS field, and is called Maria Somani. It's also one of our consultants that helps us basically design our phase 3 program. And she has shown, for example, that a 55% reduction in MRI lesions should translate into roughly about 25% reduction in relapse activity. So that's basically the relationship that was shown. And there's actually a very good correlation that she could establish between these two endpoints. But again, this is not accepted by regulatory agencies, and they would really like to see a clinical endpoint in the phase 3 program.
Thank you. And then when she looks at the correlation, is the lesions, do you think that we can use the 24-week MRI lesions data to being able to predict annualized relapse rates?
So I think, yeah, as far as biology is concerned, there's always there's not a one-to-one correlation always, but I think with the data we have from these different clinical trials with very different drugs and how the MRI endpoint relates into relapse endpoint, I think we have a relatively good handle what the assumption should be for a phase 3 trial in terms of relapse or reduction of relapse activity. And I think with most modern phase 3 trials, more or less have, for example, looked at a sample size adjustment within the phase 3 trial through an interim analysis that made sure that endpoint is adjusted so that we know exactly what sample size we should take for the phase 3 on top of this. So I think, as I said, biology always has its little quirks, but I think in general the correlation is very good, yes.
Thank you. And then, Andreas, what are the next steps post the final analysis in regards to the phase 3 design, timelines, and endpoints to the extent that you can share with us?
Yes. So as you can imagine, we have been working very hard and interacting with a lot of experts, statistical experts, clinical experts, industry experts, to really start our thinking. And we have also had interactions with regulatory agencies to discuss a potential phase 3 program for this drug, for our drug, in case that after we get the phase 2 data, and so I think we're prepared for the readout in terms of what to expect and what to do in the next steps. The other thing, of course, we have to see is the results to really we get some other interesting results out of this phase 2 study that is important for the phase 3. I already said we'd be collecting clinical endpoints, disability and relapse in this trial. We also look at other MRI endpoints that gives a better understanding, for example, of the reduction in brain volume, for example. That's very important. Also, if you look at the long-term efficacy of slowly progressing atrophy in the brain. And all of this, I think, will then further guide our thinking in terms of the phase 3. And usually what happens is after phase 2 trial, you provide a more detailed description of your phase three program to regulatory agencies in a, basically what's called an end of phase two setting. You also submit some of the other information that, that you need to have in terms of going to phase three program. For example, we have worked and been very successful in establishing a commercial size manufacturing method for IMU-838. That's also something that you would have to establish before phase three. So there are lots of other things other than the clinical program that you have to prepare for the phase three stage, and basically do this in a phase two, end of phase two meeting with the regulatory agency, and agree on the phase three program, and then basically start to execute. So all of this will take some time, probably at least a half a year between the readout and before you're able to start the phase three program, and that's also our expectations here for IMU-838.
Thank you, Andreas. And just we're going to transition to the COVID program, but just giving a plug, you know, we are working towards getting Dr. Fred Lupin, who is on the steering committee and one of the thought leaders in MS. So I think we'll dive further in the pathophysiology, current treatment options, and market opportunity in endpoints and pathways. So stay very tuned. Let's move on to COVID-19. So we had a very productive call with Dr. Michael Mills last week. Andreas, first, when do you expect to start dosing your phase two study? And then maybe tell us, you know, given that we heard from Dr. Mills on last Friday that the number of hospitalizations have been reduced here in the United States. So how may the reduction in numbers of hospitalizations in the U.S. and Europe impact your timeline to data in expected in the fourth quarter?
Yes. So I think these are very good questions. So first of all, we always said the start of the phase two is imminent, and that's absolutely true. And we hope that this will really happen very, very soon, that we can report that we had the first patient included. So I think we're working very hard to have this done on a very expedited basis, and we are looking forward to report this to you. Of course, COVID-19 as a disease is very dynamic. So we have to be very careful in terms of planning where to do the trial, what countries, what sites to include. There is, yes, decreasing activity of COVID-19, thankfully, in a lot of countries. The rate of hospitalization goes down, and the hospitals are going back to more or less doing elective surgeries again, which weren't allowed for quite a while, and so forth. So all of this, I think, is good news. And I think we have to think about also that we stay away from a lot of competitive activities, because the pharma and the biotech community really has done a very good job in terms of reacting to the COVID-19 pandemic and trying to look for different therapies and in different settings of the COVID-19 disease. And so we have had the chance to really look for some of these countries that still have a very high activity that maybe not be high on the radar screen. If you sit in the U.S., these may be smaller Southern European, Eastern European countries that still have a very high activity of COVID-19, that have basically zero competitive trials or very few competitive trials, and that allow us to enroll these patients in the COVID-19 program. So we still believe we have the ability to execute. We will have some U.S. sites, but we will have a limited exposure to U.S. Sites just for that reason. Lots of competitive activity and decreasing COVID-19 hospitalization. So, and I don't want to say too much about our countries. Some of them are published on clinicaltrials.gov, but we are screening for more and more countries where we can execute our strategy of finding patients, no competitive trials, still a very high activity. So don't want to give any guides to other companies to fight these countries.
Thank you. And Daniel, do you plan on sharing with us any additional preclinical data sets of AMU-838 and for COVID before over the next weeks and months to come?
Yeah, sure. I think it's always this research is data driven and also influencing the clinical development. So if we have new data, which is important here, we will definitely disclose that to the public. Maybe to give a little bit of a flavor of what we're working on. So we're looking for mechanistic things. How is it working, and may strengthen that. And also we'll look for potential combinations and so forth in vitro. So and that may also allow Andreas to improve the studies, and also in discussions with the doctors to have the optimum setup to do the best for the patients, which are still there. So despite some numbers going back, and there's still globally a very active disease, and it's not done yet.
And then since you spoke about combinations, maybe Andreas, can you comment on, you know, are there any other MOAs in development that could be a great combo strategy with AMU-838 for COVID?
So I'm probably not the smartest virology expert to comment on what the most important MOAs and that are in development. So I'm probably the wrong person. However, I think what's very important to us and what we have what we're also exploring is IMU-838 is a host cell antiviral mechanism. That means we're not targeting the virus itself. We're targeting the ability of the virus to basically replicate. And the virus itself cannot replicate. It can only replicate if you go into a cell, infect a human cell, and turn the cell, hijack the cell, and turn the cell basically into a virus-producing machine. So it's fully dependent on the host cell to replicate. And basically, we're making sure that a infected host cell cannot produce viruses and so forth. So by not targeting this virus, actually, it has some advantages because, for example, if the virus mutates, which may be a problem if you have a viral target, it doesn't affect, because at the end of the day, the virus still has to basically replicate using the host cell, the host cell metabolism. So I think here, basically, what we think, because we're targeting the host cell, combination with a direct antiviral drug, I think would be a very good idea, because then you basically have a two-prong approach on the virus. The virus itself gets attacked by the direct antiviral agent, and we are making sure that even if the virus escapes, that the host cell cannot be used, the host cell metabolism cannot be used to replicate the virus. So I think that, to me, is, I think, a very logical approach. And of course, the different drugs there with different viral targets, which I think we would have to see how they borne out. And I think remdesivir, of course, has probably most of the data now and have shown some indication that it works. Remdesivir also has shown some weaknesses, I think, in their clinical data. From the recent publication, you've seen that, for example, if you use it relatively late in the viral disease, it has less activity than if you use it earlier. I think that's what's known from other antiviral drugs as well. So I think here we believe that maybe a combination treatment with a DHODH inhibitor like IMU-838 basically adjust for some of the weaknesses that, for example, a direct antiviral drug has, and would be a good idea to be used in a clinical setting. And for other antiviral treatments in other indications, in hepatitis C and in HIV and so forth, what you had seen that combination treatments are always preferable to monotherapies, and I think this will also happen in COVID-19. We just have to find effective drugs to start with, and that's also why we started our COVID-1 trial, our trial of IMU-838 in COVID-19 patients. You have to establish that the drug is active in this disease, and then you probably, as a second step, you start looking for the right combinations. And we believe that we're very well positioned, basically, with a host cell mechanism for this basically second step that you will see in the treatment of COVID-19, where more and more you will look into combination treatments.
Thank you, Andreas. And then as we think about, you know, AMU-838's antiviral as well as immunomodulatory benefits, and you're in TALBOT-1 study, you have moderate and hospitalized COVID-19 patients. Which of these two are going to be far more dominant as we think about the patient segment? And then give us some color why they were chosen, again, as a reminder for for showing proof of concept.
Yes, so I think this is our first trial in COVID-19, and we're working on additional activities there in this area. But as a first trial, you look for where your drug has, where you think has the most strength. And that's why we chose these moderately ill hospitalized patients that do not have severe disease, but that had that basically not even have ventilation yet, as the patients where we believe it has the most advantage to use. And that's important to use as your first setting in a clinical trial. And this phase of the disease is where the viral replication is still rampant and ongoing in the human body. So the antiviral effect for IMU-838 is still of importance because your viral replication is there. In the later stages of the disease, for example, viral replication is not as rampant anymore. It is as not important for the disease anymore, but it's the immune reaction that really takes over the disease and really drives all the symptoms. And here, I think these patients that we chose to do the CALVID-1 study in is the intersection between where the immunosuppressive effects of DHODH inhibitors are already important, but the viral replication is still ongoing and still important for the disease development or disease course as well. So I think where we can really take advantage of this drug is where you have the intersection of these two effects of the disease, and that's where we chose to do the first trial, which is a trial that where we use IMU-838 as a monotherapy, not as a fixed combination, but in basically on top of standard of care treatments. This is where we would like to show that this drug has activity in COVID-19 patients. And that's why this first trial is important to us, because it will establish that this drug has activity in this disease.
Thank you so much. And Andreas, another quick question is, what percentage change in the proportion of patients without any need for invasive ventilation, which is the primary endpoint of CALVID, or duration of ICU treatments or cause mortalities would be compelling to give you guys confidence to move into phase 3? Is there a certain expectation that you have that you want to see in order to go and move it to the next stage of development?
Yes, so this has several layers of questions. Of course, first of all, the trial, the CALVID-1 trial, is an adaptive design. So it means what we have currently started is the phase 2 portion of the trial, which means this is where we would like to show feasibility or come to the conclusion that the drug has activity. That this doesn't mean that this is something where we have fully shown on a statistical level yet a certain treatment benefit. So we have a definition of what we consider activity. That's very well defined in the protocol and also in the charter for the IDMC, which is kind of a group of independent scientists and clinicians that will look at the unblinded data after 200 patients and determine whether there is activity of our drug in this trial. And then if that happens, basically we expand the trial into a phase 3 portion. And this is probably less driven by this interim analysis by more stringent statistical analysis that we will still do, but I think there are certain criteria that also take into consideration things, for example, that besides the clinical endpoints, for example, that a change in virus titer dynamics, for example, that we consider very important if you have a drug that is an antiviral drug. Overall, the trial, I think, yes, I had to sit down and when I designed the trial to basically say, what is the benefit that you should have that is clinically meaningful in this disease? And of course, this disease is relatively young and has lots of different data points and lots of different readouts. But I it was interesting because you many of these doctors that are now treating COVID-19 patients, they're not virologists, they're actually pneumologists that treated other patients with respiratory failure before, and they're now more or less reassigned to basically full-time COVID-19 treatments. And when I talked to them and when I had discussions with them what we should consider a outcome that is medically meaningful, they basically said, actually, for other patients that have respiratory failure, for example, for COPD, we have a very good handle what we consider meaningful, medically meaningful. There's a very nice meta-analysis that was published by Lightowler a few years ago on these patients' respiratory failure following COPD, and basically it showed that they consider meaningful what's called a number to treat of 5 for basically for avoiding invasive ventilation, and a number needed to treat of 8 in terms of avoiding death, 28, basically a change in 28-day all-cause mortality, which I think is very relevant to the COVID-19 situation as well. And basically, overall, the study was designed to basically hit these endpoints in the second part of the study and that is known from respiratory failure from COPD patients. So that's a little bit of guidance, a little bit that we took from previous respiratory failure diseases in terms of design this trial as well, because there's sometimes you have to take a little bit of hint from very similar diseases and how this develops. And still, COVID-19 could be different, but I think that gives you a very good understanding of what pneumologists consider a medically meaningful difference in ventilation rates or in death rates in these patients.
Thank you, Andreas. And now, Daniel, I know we have only 7 minutes left, and we haven't even spoken about two of the other assets that you have, AMU-935 and AMU-856. So for our listeners who are, again, getting to know the Immunic story, can you briefly maybe tell us, you know, the mechanism of action of these two assets, where they're in development, and key catalysts associated with it? I think that's maybe to the extent we can get through in 6 minutes.
Yeah, that's my experience always. There's not enough time for those beautiful two younger sisters and brothers of A2A8. But happy to share some information on that. So our second program, IMU-935, the idea behind that is to have an oral IL-17 treatment. And I think that is targeting maybe the most relevant target for that, RORγt. The molecule progressed end of last year, towards phase 1 already. And just 2 weeks ago, during our R&D day, we disclosed the first PK data from the first 5 cohorts of the single ascending dose part of the phase 1 trial. So this trial is ongoing. Again, it's as always in our company an adaptive trial, and so we expect that we continue also with the next phases of this trial MAD part, and also preparing the third part of phase 1, which will include patients with psoriasis, to also have a first view on efficacy on top of the safety we expect to get from the trial. So far, I can comment maybe a little bit on the quality. So we are very happy with the PK we've seen so far. It's really nice exposure, and given the very high activity, so IC50 is in the single digit nanomolar range in human lymphocytes on a secretion of IL-17A and F. We're very happy with what we've seen so far. So that was for 925. And as you said, there's a third molecule, IMU-856. This is a very interesting new approach. it needs an hour to speak about it because the concept is totally new. It's a yet undisclosed target. And the concept is to restore the intestinal barrier function. The molecule is named 856. So we have completed the preclinical work for that and are currently preparing a first-in-human trial, and we hope to start that as soon as possible, but definitely we expect that for this year. And I'm very excited about that totally new concept, which is, I think the uniqueness is really to not impair the immune system, whereas on the other hand, more approaching the root cause of some of the GI diseases like Crohn's, colitis, or IBS-D as examples.
Thank you, Daniel. And then we also didn't get a chance to talk in depth about the two other programs that you currently have ongoing, the CALDOS-1 study, and maybe if you could tell us where you are in terms of, you know, how many patients and for how long were patients dosed for the interim analysis that was reported last August, and sort of your development path there. And then also the study is you're running a PSC study, which is an investigator-sponsored trial at Mayo Clinic. So if you could kind of give us colors on where those two programs are would be helpful.
Yeah, so, and I'll try to make it efficient in terms of timing. Sorry, I've been accused of being too long and too talkative before. So PSC trial, this is a small, not a small, this is a rare liver disease that currently lacks any approved therapies, and we're doing basically a feasibility trial together with Mayo Clinic. This is something where since it's a rare disease, the enrollment, of course, is in a different rate. However, I think we have many of the patients already enrolled in this trial, and we hope to get a readout of this trial either at the end of this year or beginning of next year. So this is very, very much progressing. And will give us a readout that would allow us to go into a accelerated approval path here, potentially in this disease, this orphan disease, potentially orphan disease. Our phase two trial, our ongoing phase two trial in ulcerative colitis, is a little bit different story. Here we had a study designed with three active dose groups, and had done an interim analysis last year to evaluate whether one of these doses could be discontinued to really speed up the trial. And so the good news was that actually even the smallest dose, the 10 milligram dose, was found not likely ineffective, which means there must have been some activity. This was an unblinded interim analysis done by a data review committee. And basically, we will carry all three dose groups through the ulcerative colitis the trial until the end, and have a full analysis of all three dose groups and placebo in this study. And we expect to have a readout at the end of 2021 in this trial. So this is also continuing in terms of enrollment. It's a very competitive environment in terms of the clinical trials, as some of you know. So much different from MS and other diseases. So, but I believe we're doing a good job in terms of continuing this trial despite all of the COVID-19 situations. We have been able to drive this trial forward and continue this trial despite all the situations. So, I think we're very happy about the progress in this trial as well.
Thank you so much. That was very helpful, Andreas, and you were very timely to conclude. So we're coming to the end of the call. I want to say thank you on behalf of all of our listeners. We wanted to create this fireside chat for especially our clients who are starting to understand Immunic, and wanted to kind of allow this hour to get a basic understanding of what the company is. And you could probably tell numerous programs in advanced development, and if you look at the current market cap of $140 million market cap, it's definitely a name that if you haven't had a chance to work on, we're really excited to, you know, not only introduce you to the team, but also, you know, share many of our initiation reports and et cetera with you and spend some time. So with that, I want to say thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, especially with the time difference in Germany, to be with us. I also have to just close, since we spoke on this call about immunotherapeutics, that within the last 12 months, Roth has received compensation for investment banking services from Munich. Roth makes market shares in Munich and such buys and sells from customers on a principal basis. It's been such a pleasure having you on the call, and thank you again for making yourself available for this hour.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you, yes.
Big pleasure.
Thanks. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you. And that does conclude today's call. We do thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.